No, I'm technologically challenged. It's hard for me to get this recorded going. Before we go on, if anybody's got a phone on, please put it on silent. Okay. Give a warm welcome to our warm-on speaker, Dave.
Good evening. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. And first off, I'd like to start with thanking our host tonight for dinner. We had a wonderful dinner tonight. It was really nice. And that's what alcoholics. Last night I had a wonderful dinner in Fresno. I went up and saw a fellow member, Ken, was speaking in Fresno. And we went up and I got to visit with my sister, and we had a really nice dinner up there. And Captain asked me when she found out she was going to be sharing this meeting, leaving the talk speaking here. I'll get there, trust me. A long time ago, month and a half ago, she asked me if I would do the 10-minute thing, and I did what I usually do, is share, okay. And then I started thinking, okay, well, what am I going to talk about? I got to think of something good, I did what I always do, is income. Yeah. Or you can call it procrastination, whatever you want, but it is what it is. The fact of the matter is nothing was coming. Just nothing was coming. I had these little skips in my head and stuff, and they would leave as quick as they came. So I revert back to what my sponsor taught me, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And then, of course, my mind says, David, you got 10 minutes. Because there's a couple of faces in here. I think one of the first meetings that I ever spoke at, and I was going to be the full speaker. I spoke. I got up there and started talking, and when I looked up at the clock, and it was time for the meeting to be over, but I was still 21, and that's the way it works. I've never been good at speaking. When I got here, I don't know how many years I had at that point in time, but I know that when I got here, I was incapable of doing this, standing up and talking to people. I was in a recovery home, and they made you pick a home group. So I went and I found the biggest meeting in town. It was at St. Paul's, and there were a lot of people went there. And I knew that I would never have to speak there. I was safe, and that was my home group. And so I went back and announced my home group, and within a week or two after me announcing that to my home group, they took a group conscience, something I didn't know much about, but they decided to break the meeting up into tables of 10 so everyone would have a chance to talk. And that is the way that Alcoholics Anonymous and God, my higher power, works. And as time went by, I spoke for a good hour, and that's G21. And it was just a long story of my childhood, basically, is what it was, and the events of my childhood. I don't know how much time I had at that time, but I know that I was still searching for the reason why I was the way I was. And it was some time later that I was forced to, it said in the book, I could look for outside help. And something important was going on in my life, and I was totally perplexed. I was perplexed with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was perplexed with this thing you guys call God. I had been going to meetings. I had been working a program. I had been praying. I had been working my job. I had been all the things that I was supposed to be, and my life was a piece of junk. And so I went and sought some outside help, and he spent a little bit of time with me. Years, several years. But it wasn't much time after I started going with him that I guess I had given him the story of my childhood. And at some point in time, he asked me the question. He says, "Well, Dave, how old were you when you left home?" I said, "I was 17 and a half. And And he said, so you've been pretty much making your own decisions for 20 years, over 20 years now? Yeah. And he says, well, he says, maybe we don't need to look at why you're the way you are. Maybe we're going to have to look at what you're going to do about it. And that is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You know, in the book where it talks about getting down to our causes and conditions, what it is that makes me who I am. And when I got here, I knew nothing of who I was or what was the motivating factors in my life. Program taught me I was full of fear. I knew I was full of fear. I was afraid of everything. You know, everything scared me. Truly, when I got my first bank account and they gave me the little card, I'm like 37 years old. They gave me a little ATM card, and they tell you to go to that machine and push this little button and it'll give you money. You know, I really, really did not think that that was going to work for me. You know, that there's going to be some kind of little light go off, and it's going to suck my card up and just start ringing a bell and call the police or something. But Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to say that truly, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that allowed me to come in and sit in the back of the room and say nothing, just be there. The people that smiled at me, and the people that shook my hand, and the people that began to make me feel a part of by inviting me to coffee, by doing this, by doing that. That's what kept me, and that's what got me coming back and keeping me going. Not that I wasn't desperate, I was. I knew this was the last house on the block. But my ability to read the book and comprehend what I was reading. As I said, I was in therapy years after I got sober, still trying to figure out why I was the way I was. And it was the fellowship, the people that walked with me through my adventure. And for me to first identify the fears, give them a proper name, and start taking action on how to implement them in my life was a long, long process. And absolutely sober and trying the best I knew how, I still continue to make choices and decisions in my life that were not healthy for me or the people around me. And it took quite a while for me to get through to the point that I would accept the questions that my sponsor gave me. You know, David, what do you want? Because that's what all alcoholics come up with first. I know what I want. You know, and then ask yourself, who is it going to affect? And what would your God have you do? And when I truly honored those questions and contemplated the consequences for others and myself, I began to make decisions, and I began to not get near as much of what I wanted. But I found, by not doing that, that the long-term results of my choices began to let my life flourish. And for me to get to that place where it talks about in the promises where I will know peace. That I will not shut the door on the past, that I can actually look it in the face, live with it, deal with it, and use it as a tool for my future. I hope anybody that's new in this program, and as I said, or like me, that it takes a long time for you to start putting it all together, that you just don't drink and you keep coming back. And the answer will come. You know, I cannot believe today that that I have that place of peace, that I have that self-image that allows me to live with dignity and to feel that I'm a viable human being, that I'm an honest human being, not perfect by any means, but I don't go to jail anymore, you know? And I don't consider sleeping outside a true joy.
You know, I mean, it's not necessary. It's definitely not necessary. And when I got here, it was part of my life. It was an accepted part of my life. You know, so anybody that's new here, or anybody that's struggling here, never give up. Do not drink. You do not have to drink ever again. You know, there's a room full of people here that are willing and able to help. It does take a phone call. It does take a tear. It takes all the things that it takes. But if you don't drink, it will happen. And I can remember many nights late in my recovery, years down the road, sitting on a man's couch crying, how come I keep doing this stuff? How come I keep doing this? And he would just look at me and smile and say, well, you're practicing, David. Yeah. And that's what we do here. We practice the program. And if we study long enough, we get to learn. Yeah. So that's my hope for all of us here, each and every one of us, is that we keep practicing. We don't drink no matter what. And we get to find that place of peace right here in this world in our life. Yeah. So go ahead. Take a little break to enjoy the coffee and cookies, and if you'd like to get some CDs, are right there. Throw $2 on the table and pick whatever one you'd like. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get... So our main speaker, give a rousing welcome to Tessa.
Hi, I'm Catherine, and I am an alcoholic. You know, first I wanted to clear up a couple of things. One, I'm not a servant speaker. Two, I get very nervous. And three, that's all I can remember. I have three things, and you know, the thing of it is I don't want you to have really high expectations. I'm just an average alcoholic who comes in and shares their experience, strength, and hope with the other alcoholic. And hopefully I'll be able to deliver a message that you can hear and understand. And if you were like me, I needed that when I was new at the Rose of Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed somebody I could relate to. I needed to hear what it was like out there. I needed to hear a solution. And that's what I found here. Before I got here, I didn't have a solution to life at all, not even close. You know, it's really cool to be able to look out here because part of the fellowship is I get to look out amongst a bunch of people that are actually my friends today. And I get to look over at a person that's actually getting to share life with today, a meaningful life and a successful one. Those are not things I had before. I was so far away from that when I was in my disease. And you know, the sad part of that is that's all I ever wanted, I think. I think I wanted to be able to formulate relationships. I think I wanted to have people in my life, and I think I didn't know how to. So to kind of back up a little bit, my father was military, and I'll just give you a little brief history of where I came from. My father was military, so we did a lot of moving around. And before I even started drinking, we were moving a lot. And for me, as weird as this sounds, I was really okay with that even at a young age. Because every time we would move someplace, my brain would go, good, I can start over. The next place we go to, I get to start over, become a new person, and try it again. And that's kind of how I even started off life. My mom was reminding me that she had a hat that I kind of stole from her, and I would wear it, and I would put the brim way over my face. Because I really didn't want people to see me, and we're talking before the age of 11. You know, and I really just kind of grew up wanting to hide my face because I was just so full of fear. You know, that fear that's talked about around here. I was fearful from the get-go. And I'm not really sure, you know, there's nothing I can really pinpoint it on. I was raised right. I had good parents. You know, everybody has their flaws. I can sit here and tell you what my parents may or may not have done wrong, but it certainly isn't their fault. And I had the ability to have a good life. It's just, for some reason, I was incapable of it. When I was around other kids, I felt out of place, and I felt like I didn't belong. And I think there was just a part of me that always felt like that before I started drinking. So we lived over in Europe. When I was, I think, in like kindergarten, I want to say, we moved over to Europe, and we were talking at dinner tonight. And again, thank you, Rick. I do appreciate the dinner. I got to be a 10-minute speaker not too long ago and got to have dinner and agreed to be the hour speaker only so I could go have dinner. That's what my motivation was. I wanted that dinner. When we were over in Europe, we were talking at dinner tonight that it's kind of odd that most of us, my father would make sure that when we were living there that we would travel all over the place, that I got to see a lot of the world. And instead of being one of those little girls that were collecting charms or collecting spoons or all these little knickknacks from all the different countries, I was the one that picked out the shot glass. And I had a collection of shot glasses when I came back from Germany when I was 11 years old, and I think that's just my brain. And, you know, I didn't start drinking early, like before 11, but I did try cigarettes. You know, I thought that sounded fun. And we used to try to smoke them, and when I say try to, I didn't inhale them. But I would steal them from my father, and a few of us kids would go out into the woods, and we would smoke these cigarettes. And I was just trying to be somebody. You know, I was just trying to do something that would make me somebody, and I don't know why I thought smoking would be the one. I think it's because my father did it. And, you know, most little girls want to grow up like their mother, and not me. I had this thing about where I wanted to grow up like my father. I wanted to emulate him, and I wanted to be just like him. And he was a drinker. He was a heavy drinker, and he was a heavy smoker. So I started off with a cigarette. So we did all this traveling, and I wasn't learning how to form relationships. I felt out of place with everybody. I felt out of place with my own family. We moved back to the United States, and I really then started feeling out of place. I come back to an area that is actually foreign to me because I was so young when I was doing what I was doing. We ate different food here. There was fast food restaurants. I'm old enough that back then there wasn't fast food in Europe. I mean, that just wasn't back there yet. So I didn't have fast food until I came here. So you take this little scared little girl who feels uncomfortable anyway and throw them into a system that thinks she should belong because I'm American. Everybody's not kind of holding my hand through it. And I just panicked. I panicked and thoroughly just kind of isolated from the world. And until I met these guys who had this alcohol, and I was 11, and these are the first kids that I was really introduced to that had something that I wanted, because they invited me in, and they looked like they were having fun, they seemed like they were being comfortable with each other, and it actually wasn't something that I was afraid of that I wasn't going to be able to do. You know, it wasn't like cheerleading or acting or, you know, some kind of club. It was something I actually thought I could join in and do with them and have fun. So I tried it, and that very first time at the age of 11 when I tried alcohol, I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I never had to acquire a taste for it. I actually liked the taste of it. I liked what it did for me. The only thing I didn't like really was beer. I never acquired a taste for that, but I certainly would drink it if there was nothing else around. Because that's the kind of alcoholic I am. If I was going to drink, I would drink anything in front of me. But I loved Jack Daniels. And the reason I loved Jack Daniels is because that's what my father drank. And that was my connection with him. So the only way I realistically knew how to formulate connections with people at this point, at the age of 11, is through alcohol. I was trying to connect up with my father. I was trying to connect up with the kids that were doing that. And when I drank the alcohol, it gave me that relief. I felt like that was the solution. It gave me that relief that allowed me to be that person, that child that I always wanted to be. And I was prettier in my mind. I was more intelligent in my mind. I was more outgoing. You know, it was just more of everything. And I didn't have to wear that hat anymore, and I was able to do other things. I was able to dance. I was able to join those clubs that we were talking about. I was able to become a pom-pom girl. You know, that's the kind of stuff alcohol allowed me to do, because it gave me that courage. It took away the fear. And for me, my alcohol, I don't know, it told me these things, that that's what it was doing for me, but looking back on it, I don't really think that's who I was, because I really still didn't have any friends. You know, they weren't really friends. I never was, even still then, able to have a friendship. And we were just drinking together. We were just drinking, and I was off doing activities and trying to keep up with grades. Because in my family, you had to have grades. You had to do school. You had to be in, you know, being a commander of a base, you had to act a certain way, dress a certain way, be a certain person. So not only am I feeling awkward enough as it is, I have a father and mother who's promoting. This is who you need to be. And it needed to be almost in my mind, you know, that's my perception of it, was a feeling of needing to be perfect. And so that for me was a lot to live up to, you know, and I think me being an alcoholic, you know, talks about in one of the books about having that magnifying mind. And I think I did that. I just kind of magnified everything. I magnified what was said to me. I magnified what my perception of myself was. Everything was just overblown. And so when my father tells me, you should have a C in this class, so take it over again because you didn't get one, I just took it as, you're not good enough. I didn't take it as, you're in math, maybe you might want to try it again, so when you build on your math, you might do better next year. And it wasn't really about the A, and it wasn't really about me not being good enough. It was about him trying to help me. And so that's kind of how I lived my life. And the more I felt that way, the more I drank over it. And this whole time, we're moving around, every time I'm still feeling that same way. I'm going to be a different person. I'm going to have friends this next time. I'm going to know how to do it differently. And I never could. And those decisions that I was, because at this point, you know, when I was 11 and I started, let me back up for a minute. When I was 11 and I took that first drink, I drank on a daily basis from the age of 11 to the age of 30 when I got here. I was not one of those who drank and did free drinks. Is drinking, you know, I drank every day. I altered my mood every day. I wasn't necessarily drunk, but I altered my mood every day to be able to live life. That's how I was able to do it. That's how I was able to get through school and college. You know, I went through junior high school, college, under those conditions. That was the only way I knew how to do it. And I walked out of high school with actually no friends. I was talking on the phone the other day with a friend from North Carolina, who went to a different high school than me, but he had brought up about the fact that my 30-year high school graduation was coming up, reunion, and he said, are you going to come? You know, you should come. I'm like, I don't know these people, and he doesn't get it. He's like, oh, more people would remember you, and I thought, yeah, the ones that remember me probably aren't the ones I want to remember me, because I know the things they remember, and it's not the stuff I want to go back and talk about. You know, those are not the things I want to talk about. So I just kind of lived my life that way, floating through, doing the best that I thought I could, but never feeling good enough. And the more I felt like that, the more I drank. And it just progressively got worse. And as I got out into the work world, because I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I got a business degree, and the way I looked at it, I just wanted to be somebody. And for me, I didn't want to join the military and be like my dad, but he was in charge. And again, I wanted to be like my father. So I decided, okay, if I work in an office, have my own office, and wear a suit and carry a briefcase, I'll be somebody. I didn't necessarily care what it was I was doing. I just wanted to emulate this. So that's what I did. And off I went, and I started working. And I was successful. I worked my way up the corporate ladder. But as I was working up that corporate ladder, I kept moving. I moved from one place to the next and never really gave myself an opportunity to be fired. You know, as I was going through my life, drinking, I just always thought that I was still good enough, that I was a good worker. I justified it and just thought, oh, I'm out of here, I'm up to a new job, and I'm okay with all of this. But, you know, looking back at it now that I'm sober, I can look back and go, no, that was not what was going on. I think I escaped by my skin, you know. And so I did that. And by this point, after I got out of college, the next thing a person is supposed to do, this is before my work history began, you get married. So I got married, and the gentleman I decided to marry was the one who didn't drink. You hear around here a lot of people say, I married my drinking partner. I married the guy who didn't drink because my first thought was, who? Designated driver. You know, that made sense to me. I mean, that made total sense to me. I didn't know until I got here that that's not normal. And so, and then I wondered why it didn't last. So, but, you know, so we did the traveling around stuff, and we just, I tried to be a good wife, but I wasn't. And, but I became a workaholic and an alcoholic. And so that's my life at that point. And I'm 24 years old. And I'm a marketing director for a regional shopping center down in Southern California. And thinking I have it all going on because I'm in charge and I'm married. And I'm a workaholic, and I never have to see him, and I get to drink as much as I want because he doesn't drink, and he doesn't know any different, and he doesn't really care. And that was like heaven to me. But it just didn't work. It just didn't work. And he was military. Oh, that was smart. Because he moved around a lot, too. That kind of kept up with the pattern of my life. That made sense to me as well. Marry a military guy. We get to keep moving. I liked geographic. That made sense in my life. And so he was military, and we kept moving around, and I kept thinking, oh, okay, this job's going to be different. I'm going to be different. My friends are going to be different. Things are going to be different. I never once thought, I'm going to drink differently. That never crossed my mind. I never once thought, I need to change that part of my life. You know, my brain never connected up that alcohol had anything to do with the decisions I was making in my life. And what's strange is, okay, I have a baby now, because that's your next thing to do. I'm trying to lead this normal life. The next thing you do is have a baby. So I had a baby. And I think this is probably the hardest part of my story, is to go through the admission of the fact that as a new mother, most new mothers, I understand, which I understand today would be the case for me as well as a sober woman, but as an alcoholic woman, I chose not to drink while I was pregnant. And that was the only time I didn't choose to drink. And the only way I was able to do that was not out of, I would love to sit here and say it was because I was being unselfish, but it was because I didn't want to look bad. Because I knew that women who were pregnant weren't supposed to drink. And so I suffered through that. That's how I felt. I'm suffering through my pregnancy, not drinking, and going completely insane because I had drank daily since I was 11. And I had a lot of health problems during it, and I think it was partly because I didn't have the sugar in me. I didn't have the alcohol in me. And so I had a premature baby. And when we finally got to bring him home, and I got to come home, it wasn't the excitement of bringing my child home. It was the excitement of going home to my alcohol. And I brought this baby in, and I had him to his father. And being the good enabler and husband he was to me at that time, he had a cake there waiting for me, a sign, and a bottle of alcohol, which happens to be the first picture of my baby book. Here's my alcohol. And so I handed this child over to my husband and said, here, and I just proceeded to drink. And I'm not sure if it's because I had put down the drink long enough to get it out of my system, but when I picked it back up, it proceeded to get worse. You know, when they talk about it gets worse, never better, I started drinking even worse than I was before. It started to actually get unmanageable. My life had been semi-manageable, you know, up to that point. But at this point, after this, things started to go into the unmanageable period, and I was doing things that was totally unacceptable. Now, I had made poor decisions prior to this, decisions that were not good for my life, decisions that I regret having made, and I was always a drink until you pass out, because I thought that's how normal people drink, and I was always a person who drank to blackout, and I just did that, and I thought that was normal. But it's really not normal to drink and blackout and drive, because I was always a driver. And I'll tell you something about driving. You know, My brain can rationalize and justify anything. I never thought I was a drunk driver, a driver who would drink and drive, because I would drink before I got in the car, and then I would drive. I never drank while I was driving, you know? That makes sense to me. You know, so long as I'm not in there drinking while I'm driving, it's okay. And that's how I was allowing myself to drink and do these things. And so, anyways, as I was doing that, then it allowed me to actually drink and drive and black out with an infant in my car. And that's where my alcohol took me. I put my son's life in danger. Here's this infant baby who has no control over this. And the insanity of it comes along with the fact that I would wake up the next morning. Now, I'm assuming my husband at the time would have told me, where's our son, or, you know, something. But, you know, I would wake up the next morning, and as usual, before the son was even born, I would think, oh, how did I get home? Is my car here? I better go check. So that was my normal pattern anyway. All I've done is thrown a son into the mix now, a baby. And it's like, oh, where's my car? Is it out there? Did I make it home with the car? How did I get home? And then the next thought started to become, is my son in his crib? And I would panic and I would go look. The insanity of this, though, is a normal drinker would not do that a second time. An alcoholic does it over and over and over again. You know, drinking that alcohol made me forget the consequences that were involved in it. I may not have ever gone to jail. I may not have ever gone and gotten a DUI. I should have multiple times. But there were heavy consequences that were there waiting for me. You know, my son's alive today, and that's the good news. Other people are alive today, and that's even good news. You know, I never hurt anybody in that process. But, you know, I know today if I drink, there's always still that possibility, because I don't think about the consequences that can be attached to what's going on around me when I'm drinking. The drink becomes more important than anything else in my life. More important than my son, more important than my job, more important to those relationships that I so desperately wanted. And I couldn't understand why these friends of mine would write like 18 pages. I remember a girl, she wrote me an 18-page letter. I don't know if it was 18 pages, but it was long. I always magnify stuff, but it was a long letter. And she was telling me exactly why she didn't want to be my friend anymore. And, you know, if I truly wanted to have a friend, you would think I'd read it and go, oh, I get it. You know, I want to figure this out. I just looked at it as, what's her problem? She's the one with the problem, not me. You know, it was always somebody else's problem, not mine. I couldn't see me for who I was. And so the drinking just progressively got worse. And somehow I managed to get a job that right in, let's see, where was I living? At this point, hard to keep up. I'm sorry, right, where was I living? I was living in the state of Washington. And we lived on an island, which I absolutely hated because I liked the city. Lots of life, lots of activity, lots of drinking places. Because I, you know, this is the other thing as a drinker that was justifying how she drank. I never really thought I went to the bar. Yeah, I went to the club. I had a reason to go there. I was dancing. Didn't think about that's why I was there, was to actually drink, you know, because I drank more than I danced. And I went to the sports bar because I liked sports. So I was actually watching sports. You know, this is how my mind allowed me to do what I was doing. Because I don't know if I could see the reality of it. I don't think I could handle the reality of it. But anyway, back to, I was in Washington and I actually got a job that would promote me somehow. They said I was doing a good job and wanted me to go manage this part of their branch that was actually failing in Denver. And so I accepted the position. And he said, my marriage at this point was failing. My son was, I guess, two, and I decided to accept the position. And we were going to go out there, and I thought, okay, maybe this will change it, change my marriage, change how I'm feeling about things. So I accepted the job, and we moved on out to Denver, Colorado. And in the interim, my husband had to stay in Southern California to finish up his work for about 3 months. My mother was living here in Visalia. She said, I'll watch the son in between. You go out and start working. Oh, my God, that was the best news. You know, no responsibilities, no child, no husband. But I didn't know what I was in for. I got out there and I had 3 months of just me. And that was scary. That was really scary. I had no responsibilities to anybody else. And I could do whatever I want and I can't even tell you what I did. Most of it was in blackout. And most of it was ending up in places and waking up and I didn't know where I was or who I was with. Because the people that I would go with or when I would drive there on my own, I would end up places I didn't know. And this makes sense. I would go to my job the next day because I always knew that I had to work or I would have a problem. I had to make sure that I was at work. Only people with a problem don't make it to work. So I would always make it to work and I would be in the same suit explaining to them I was sick. Now, that makes no sense. Why would you come in the same suit? But I hadn't gone home. I'd been out all night. So those things made sense to me, and this is the insanity of my thinking. And it just progressively got worse. I started to care about nothing. I didn't care about the job at this point, and I was just doing the best I could do again just to hang on. And my son finally moved out, and my husband finally moved out there, and I had been hurting a lot, more than I ever had in my entire drinking career, because I had nobody to answer to, and at this point, I felt like I didn't have to. I thought, you know what, this is just on, this is me. I had started consuming so much that it was all really, really just about me. And I would also say that I'm never going to drink in the morning. Drinking in the morning means you have a problem. So I would drink until like 4 o'clock in the morning, go to sleep for a couple of hours, and then go to work. And wait until noon. Noon's acceptable. That's not morning time. So I would just like white knuckle it until noon. And that's how I drank. That's how I drank on a daily basis. And I never did drink in the morning, but it just progressively got earlier and earlier in the day, and I slept less and less. And I just was holding on until noon, and it was just total insanity. That was my entire life. The drink had become the only thing I could think about. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about it. I heard that here, and I totally related to that. My whole life obsessed around it. How am I going to get that drink? When am I going to get that drink? And how much am I going to get to drink? And that was my life at the end. That's exactly what I did. And it got worse during the course of the time because all those things I just mentioned to you that I would never do, which one of them also was not to drink alone. I would make people drink with me. And if I couldn't find somebody to drink with me because I was running out of friends easily, I would go to that sports bar that I talked about that wasn't a bar and take my briefcase and set it on the table and act like I was working so I could drink. Because I didn't want to go home and drink, and I didn't want to drink in the bar by myself. And so this, you know, that's the way I thought. And at the end, that became irrelevant to me anymore. I didn't even care. I was missing work because I was sick. I was drinking alone at night in my room at my house. I was divorced. I was getting ready to lose my job. I didn't realize it, but I was. And it became miserable. The things I said I was never going to do. I never said I'm never going to drive drunk. I never said that I wouldn't go to work and drink at noon. I never said those things. But all the things, all those boundaries I had put on myself about my drinking, I crossed over. And I started doing them. I started allowing them to happen because it was over. That was it. And I started spiraling down. And at this point, I lost all control. And in about a year's time, I didn't have a job any longer. The divorce was finalized. I was in financial ruin, and I was living out in Denver, Colorado by myself, basically. No friends. My family wouldn't talk to me anymore except for my mother. And my mother called me, and after she knew I didn't have a job, because she knew I didn't have a job, so I called her and said, I don't know why they don't want me here anymore, because I don't understand. They said I'm not stable. And I didn't understand this. I didn't understand why they thought I wasn't a stable person. And so she was trying to explain to me, and I just didn't understand it. And so she started talking me into coming back here to Visalia, because she had moved here many, many years ago. And I didn't want to come. The only person left in my life that would really have anything to do with me, I don't know. I wanted to stay in that apartment by myself for the rest of my life and drink, I think. I really believe that's what I wanted to do, and I'm not sure how I thought that was going to work out. I just believed it would, and that I was going to be okay. But thank God she finally managed to talk me into coming here, and I conceded, and she said, I'm going to put you on a train. You're going to ride and have a nice little trip through the mountains and through all of this. Bring your son. And I said, okay. So I get on the train, and she didn't put me in one of those nice beds. She just put me on one of those chairs that you stay up all night or sleep uncomfortably in, but not me. I found some guy, and he got me a bed up there, and I got to sleep comfortably and pass out because I was drinking, and woke up the next morning. I was like, oh, okay, well, this is cool, and I always got what I wanted, it almost seemed like. So I get there, and I walk off, and the train with my son, and you know, I wasn't happy to be here. And I hear my mother talking today about what it was like seeing me come home, because I certainly wasn't the person that she saw when I left. At this point, I came back to Norm from Colorado to California weighing possibly 95 pounds. My hair was falling out. I was very sick, sick at the side. Not only physically, but spiritually, emotionally, and mentally. And that was who I was. I had, towards the end of my drinking, I had stopped eating. I wasn't eating, I was just drinking. I was lucky if I got some popcorn and some cheese down. I can remember that was my dinner. I would eat popcorn and cheese while I was watching David Letterman and drinking. That was my life. How fun. And that's where I said I would never go. That's where I said I would never go, and that's where I ended up. And so I came back here, and the only condition my mother said that was for her, for me to live with her, was that I couldn't drink in her house. And partly because I have a problem, and partly because I didn't have any money. You know, she's like, you don't have any money, what are you going to drink with? And you have a problem. She's been telling me that since I was in college. And so I proceeded to say, okay, because I honestly thought in my head, I can do that. Well, that first day I knew I couldn't do that. Not by that night, I was already out. I'm trying to remember where I went. I think it was Captain Cleaver. That's where I went. I went to the Captain Cleaver, because that's not a bar. It was a restaurant. So I went there and I met some guys, and if I don't know if you've heard the pattern yet, but it's always guys, because they would buy me the drink. And so I didn't have to spend a lot of money. I didn't have any friends. My mother's not giving me money to buy drinks. I couldn't drink in her house what she had in there. So I would go out and meet these guys, befriend them, and get my drink. And that's how I was living my life when I first moved here. And my ex-husband at the time said, you know what, I'm going to take your son. You've got a definite problem. I didn't know what he was talking about. I had no idea. I was clueless. It just scared me, though. So he took my son and said, you know, you need to do something. And, oh, wait, no, that's wrong. He hadn't taken him yet. My son's still with me. He left him with me. My ex-husband moved to Illinois, and my son's living here with me, and I'm trying to manage to take care of him. In reality, my mother was taking care of him. The only thing I used my mother for was the use of her bed, her shower, her washer and dryer, and her food. And the rest of the time I didn't stay in her house because I couldn't drink there. And I just kind of was running amok. So I was using my mother, and while she was taking care of my son, and I was doing what I wanted to do. And that's how I started to live for a couple of months here. That was in November of 1994. And in March is my birthday, my belly button birthday. And in February, somebody had mentioned to me that, oh, you know, I guess I had mentioned about how I was going to be turning 30 really soon. And this was in February, so in March is my belly button birthday, and I'm going to be 30. And somebody was trying to console me and saying, oh, you know, it's okay, you're only going to be 30. That's not too old. You know, you still have a long life ahead of you. And as soon as that person said that, it clicked that I was done. I thought, I can't do this anymore. That scared me. And it wasn't that I was done drinking, because I still had no idea that I had a problem with drinking. It was just that I was done with life. I was so empty and so miserable and so sad, and I hate to say it, but so pathetic. I was just done. So I proceeded to take care of my son that day, helped him make Valentine's cards for kids in his class that was coming up, and because this was in February, and somehow I got through the day, but by that night, I decided that it was done, and I was done, and that everybody, including myself, would be better off without me being here. And I always have the hardest time saying this. This is the second hardest thing that I have to say, other than admitting what I did with my son, you know, the way I raised him and the way I wasn't there for him. But I tried to commit suicide. And after 17 years, you would think those words would roll out a little bit easier, but it still just baffles me that that's where alcohol took me, that that's where my life had become. And I ended up in the hospital. And you know what's so funny is it took a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to recognize. It's not that I didn't want to admit it. It's just that I didn't even really recognize it, that I was in a mental institution. You know, they kept me in a mental institution for 2 weeks. And it talks about in the book how we end up in jail, destitution, or death. And it didn't dawn on me until I was saying it one time that that was never me, and thank God, and then all of a sudden it clicked. I was like, wait a minute, I was in a mental institution before I even got sober. I was so insane, so suicidal, so done with life that I had to spend 2 weeks in a mental institution. And when I left there, I still didn't know it. I still didn't get it. I just thought I was depressed, and I thought that was going to be my life. And so what did I do? I proceeded to meet the guys in the mental institution who would buy me drinks on the outside. And that's what I did. And so now I'm hanging out with the guys from the mental institution buying me drinks. And I thought that was acceptable. And so my life has become very acceptable for me to do these things and to hurt my family and to hurt myself. My life was self-destructing. I was destructing my family. I was self-destructing myself. And I was okay with all of this. It was acceptable. And so I did that. Now this has been 95 by now, so I moved here. So I've been going through this for a few months. And so March of 95, this happened. And so you know that guy I said that I met in the mental institution? I originally called him a gentleman, but I was taught here too that not all guys are gentlemen. And I found out he's not really a gentleman. That's probably why he's hanging out with some of the guys that he's hanging out with. But because I didn't know the difference, I thought it was totally okay that they do what they do to me. But I let this guy talk to me and was telling me, because I kept telling him, you know, I think my family really thinks I have a problem. You know, they don't understand what my real problems are. It's people, it's places, it's situations in my life. And they think I have a problem with my alcohol. And he's like, ah, he goes, I can help you with that. He goes, I have this court card. And he goes, I have to go to these AA meetings. I'd never heard of AA. He goes, I have to go to these AA meetings. You can come there and you can find, you know, you can let them tell you. And I was like, perfect. Because I just knew I had it more going on than you guys. And so I was like, perfect, I'll go there. And so he takes me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I thought, so I kind of say always that I came halfway on a court card. Thank God he was on a court card, because if it hadn't been for him, I don't know where I would have ended up. But he came here, and he's not around anymore, by the way. He didn't stick around, but he got me here. And so we come in, and it's at the Alana Club, and my objective was to sit down next to somebody, and I got all dressed up, and I'm sure I didn't look that good, but in my magnifying mind, I was beautiful. I was like Miss America, you know? And I walk into the Alana Club looking at you guys like, oh my God, what a bunch of Delericks. And I've taken up with these kinds of people before, and worse, you know? But I don't know. So I go into the Alana Club, and I was going to sit down, and that alcoholic that was sitting there was going to tell me I didn't belong. And I was very angry about having to do this. So I walked in very angry, and I was angry at all of you guys. I was angry at my family. I was angry about my life. I was angry that I lived. And so I go in there, and I sit down, and I was said, welcome. Glad you're here. Keep coming back. And smiled at me. And I was like, are you kidding? I was so pissed. I was like, are you kidding me? You don't know who I am. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go back again the next day and sit somewhere else by somebody else. Now, I could have gone to a different meeting if I had known they even had them. I thought that was like the only AA meeting in the entire world. So I go back to the same meeting, and I sit down somewhere else by someone else, and they told me the same thing. Hi, welcome. Keep coming back. So glad you're here. I'm like, are you kidding? So I always say I did this for 2 weeks. I didn't know how long I did it. It could have been 2 days. It could have been 2 weeks. It could have been a freaking month. No, I'm putting up fingers. I know my sobriety date. But it was not long. But it was long enough, you know. But I came back every day, not because you guys told me to, but because I wanted you guys to tell me I didn't belong. Because I was so angry. I was mad at you guys. And I thought, why are they happy? Why are they laughing? Why are they doing these things? Don't they know they're miserable? Because I knew you guys were just like me. And so I kept going back, and nobody would tell me I could go home. And I did this. And I was drinking before the meeting. I was drinking after the meeting. It's kind of like the car situation. But I wasn't drinking in your meetings. You were pretty lucky. So I just kept doing that. And then on the last day, oh, and then for those of us who know John Cody, he was the secretary at that time of the Alana Club. And I love this story because I finally figured it out in my smart mind. He's the one that's going to tell me I'm not an alcoholic because he's the president of Alcoholics Anonymous and he's in charge of all of the alcoholics. I go up there and he tells me the same thing. Keep coming back, and I was pissed. So I came, but I got to find, as I was leaving, I saw the little grocery things and I grabbed one, and it wasn't me, it was God. I didn't want information. I didn't want to know you people. And I grabbed it out of there, took it home, and I found out it was a test. I was like, perfect. I'm going to pass. It's on paper. I can show my family. All good. So I took it. I passed. It was on paper. And I cried hysterically because I found out I was an alcoholic. And right at that moment, I had to accept something I was unwilling to accept. And because I was crying so hysterically, my mother heard me from the back of the house, and she comes running over thinking something terrible has happened. And I'm holding this paper in my hand, and she goes, what's wrong? I said, I'm an alcoholic. She goes, I know. And she's all excited. So she's excited. I'm crying. And I said, I wish I had a video of this. And so that's how I started my journey, because I had come here, and I had been introduced to the room, and I knew where to go back because you guys told me, come back. We want you here. And so I felt comfortable enough to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Granted, I went back to the Alana Club at that time because that's the only one I knew about. And I walked in, and instead of trying to find out I didn't belong, I started listening to find out if I did belong. I thought maybe I took the test wrong. But I found, but no such luck. No, that is a good thing. But that's what I was doing. I was making sure that I was belonging here, and I got to listen, and I got to listen to the similarities instead of the differences now. Well, before I wasn't even listening. But I got to listen to who you were and found out I'm just like you. I drank like an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I can't just drink one drink. I never have my entire life. I watch my mother drink half a glass of wine at night and go to bed, and it pisses me off. You know, I've never understood that way of life. I've never had just one drink. I found out that my life was totally unmanageable. I found out that it was manageable because I drank. And I was living a life, making decisions based on an altered state of mind that was totally insane. That's who I am. That's who I was. And I thought this whole time that as I was making these decisions for my life, and as I was doing the things that I was doing, and as I was feeling all this shame and remorse and guilt and self-hatred about it, and feeling that hole in my soul because of the lack of quiet, you know, having that spiritual malady that was going on, I really thought I was just a bad person. You know, and what I got to find out from Alcoholics Anonymous, when I first got here, my first sponsor said, before you even do step one to find out about any of this, you need to understand, you have a disease. You have a disease that's called alcoholism. I have never heard of such a thing. I didn't even know that existed. And she taught me about it. We read the big book, The Doctor's Opinion, and she talked about me in there. and I related to it. And I got to learn about the obsession, and that's exactly who I was. And I got to learn about the craving. That's exactly what was going on. And I got to learn that I had a disease. I have a disease. And I got to learn that this is where the solution is, and that there is no cure, that I only get a day sober based on my spiritual condition. That reprieve comes based on how I stay sober, how I can maintain my spiritual contact with my God here. And I got to learn to break down those old ideas about a God. And I got to get rid of them. And I got to develop one here that works for me. I got to develop a relationship, first one I've ever had, here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. A first working relationship. Now, I didn't do this immediately. Immediately I developed a relationship with a man. Just like I was told not to, but that's what I needed to do. And so I developed a relationship with a man. I got married. I tried to practice these things. I practiced them well enough to stay sober. I honestly believe that my God was keeping me sober because I was still willing. I was so willing to stay sober. I was so willing to still try to work the steps and do the best of my abilities. And as Abraham put it, to the best of my willingness, that God honored my sobriety. But, you know, I wasn't really working on that real relationship with a God of my own understanding. I was working on a relationship with a man of my understanding, which was my normal pattern. And so, as you probably realize, that relationship didn't work. And we got divorced because we did get married, and we got divorced. And that was the first 5 years of my sobriety. And I did the best I could. And I did well enough to stick around and stay sober long enough to recognize that, you know what, I need to do something different. This isn't working. When they say, how's it working for you? It's not. It still wasn't working for me. My life was better, but it still wasn't what I wanted. So I got to learn that I needed to put God first. I got to learn how to develop a relationship with a higher power and to have that be my primary relationship. And if I want those relationships that I've always wanted in my life, that I could never seem to have, that I never could seem to cope with, then I better figure it out with God. I better figure it out with myself. I better be okay with me and have a relationship with me, and I better be okay with my higher power who's going to keep me sober so that I can actually formulate those relationships with you guys. And I can look out here today. I had one of my friends who got sober at the same time as me come up and say, I'm here tonight. I promised you I would be, and today I keep my promise. You know, nobody did that for me before. You know, those are the blessings from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a friend who's not even in AA in 17 years, and she's not a member of AA, but you know what? She takes me. She accepts me. And that never happened. That's the longest relationship I've ever had. And I never ventured to believe that that kind of stuff would happen. I've had to walk through a lot of stuff in sobriety. It wasn't all fun. I've had a lot of fun here, but I have gone through a divorce. I experienced the joyness of getting married. I was excited about getting married. I experienced that without getting drunk. I also experienced the divorce of it, and I didn't get drunk. You know, I got sick. I was at a job. Didn't wait till noon to drink. You know, I was reading my big book at my break, make sure, and I was going to a meeting every single day at noon at Badalano Club for 5 years every day, because that's when I used to start drinking. And I was in that meeting so that I wouldn't drink. You know, those are the kinds of things I did to stay sober. And I can remember the people in my work would come out and say, what are you doing? And I'm like hiding my book. I'm reading, you know, I didn't want them to know. And I also didn't want to know, this is the funny part, I didn't want to know the first spiritual retreat I went with on was actually through a church, because I went to the church, and I used to belong to a church, because that's where he went. And so I went on this spiritual retreat, and I knew I couldn't go without my big book. There was no way I could go a whole weekend without my big book. So instead of preparing for it, I just was ready to take it, and I had to run around the house looking for a book cover from another book that would fit it so that nobody would see what I was reading, because I just wasn't ready to go there yet, you know? But anyway, so God is good, because he put me in that room with a person in Al-Anon. you know, so it worked out. God's always been good. So God has carried me through a lot of stuff. You know, He carried me through a job that didn't last. He carried me through, because I got ill, He carried me through an illness, a severe illness. And I don't generally talk about this too much, but I want you to know, if you're new in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that no matter what, it says in the book, wife, no wife, job, no job. And I'm here to say too, illness, no illness. You can stay sober. I was paralyzed from the neck down, and it's about 4 years later, and I'm hopefully going to get off a cane soon. I've said that twice now. I had like a little relapse in the medical part of it, but, you know, I didn't drink. I did not drink. And I maintained those relationships. I didn't push people away. I actually let people help me. I couldn't make it to all the meetings I wanted to, but I was certainly willing to talk to people on the phone. I was certainly willing to have people come see me at my house. I was certainly willing to do whatever I needed to do. And the minute I could get out on a walker, one of the friends in AA picked me up and took me to a meeting. And that's how it works here for me. That's how it works. It's a simple program that I sometimes complicate. But it's a simple program that if I work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and live by those principles to the best that I know how, I get to have a day of sobriety. And not only do I get to have a day of sobriety, I get to have a day of emotional sobriety, which means I'm not a tornado through those lives anymore. And I'm not a tornado in my own life. I don't have that emotional turmoil inside anymore. That peace and serenity is there. And it's not always there. I'm not going to say it's there 24 hours, you know, every 7 days a week. But, you know, it's there more times than not. And that's the blessing of this program. And I'll have to say that the best relationship that I've ever had in my life, outside of the one that I get with my higher power, is with the man that's sitting over there. And I never really thought that was going to happen. And he was one of those that was here when I first got here. He has more time of sobriety than I do. And he was one of those that I watched walk through this program, and I wanted to emulate him. And he was one of those that I got to listen to that I respected. I asked him to speak tonight as my warm-up, not just because I admire him, but because I believe in his message. And I couldn't say that about any other man that I've ever been with. I never believed in any of their messages. You know? And so, you know, but today I was... Now, I'll tell you why that can happen today. That can happen today because I have my own self-respect. And I want to get self-respect for, because I didn't respect myself before I got here. I didn't respect myself today because of the relationship I have with my God and because of my sobriety, because I'm not doing the things I was out there doing when I was drinking. Today, I'm a sober woman of Alcoholics Anonymous, who tries very hard to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And sometimes I do a better job of it than other times. But I certainly never forget where I came from. I certainly never forget who I am. I certainly know that there is no cure. And I certainly know that this is a lifelong process. And I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to say, because this so outweighs whatever I've ever had in my entire life, from the day I put that first cigarette in my mouth, or put that cap on my head, or collected those little shot glasses, or took that first drink. You know, this far outweighs it. And so I want to thank everybody for allowing me to come and share part of my sobriety. And I want to say to you what I heard here when I first got here as well, that I didn't understand. Thank you for being my family. Because I didn't understand that when I first got here, I thought that was so stupid. I was like, oh, you poor people, you bunch of alkies, you have to have each other for a family. And then I looked around, and guess what? I didn't have a family. So I appreciate it, and thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for allowing me to be here. Thank you.
I want to thank our speakers. They did a magnificent job. We're passing out flyers right now for the gentleman from President who's going to speak next month. And I'm just going to make a personal appeal. Please show up. The guy's coming from almost Auberry. He lives in, between Auberry and Fresno, and he's coming all the way down to Tulare, you know, to share his experience, strength, and hope. And I'd like to at least, you know, fill the room up and, you know, show him some appreciation. And besides, you can ask Abraham. He's got a hell of a pitch. So if you don't show up, you're going to be doing yourself a disservice, like the people who didn't show up tonight did themselves. So we hope to see you here next month. And the featured speaker next month is Art M. from Fresno. And he's got a great pitch. He's an attorney and he's really, really funny. You'll enjoy it. And do we have any other AA announcements?
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Just donated Springville Speakers Breakfast Meeting.